Happy Saturday. It's September 13th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
And we are two of your Airmail editors who are here to provide a break from the news of the day. In the United States, the assassination of far-right Gen Z influencer Charlie Kirk is dominating the news cycle. But meanwhile, in the UK, on Thursday, Keir Starmer fired, or sacked as we say in these parts, his ambassador to Washington. Peter Mandelson, or Lord Mandelson around here, was yet another master of the universe who has been brought down by his too close ties to Jeffrey Epstein, as was revealed this week when his emails and correspondence with the sex offender were published. And in London, traffic on the M4 highway was especially bad this week to the tube strike, or a strike among the conductors of our subway. But still, many locals blame the worst of it on Thursday night on, who else? Prince Harry. He was here visiting the King at Clarence House in his first face-to-face visit in 18 months on Thursday afternoon. It lasted just 54 minutes. And some are wondering, will it spark a reconciliation? Is he intending or hoping to move back to the UK? Time will tell, and we shall be following every minute of it. But first, as always, Airmail and Morning Meeting are the antidote to the traumas and dramas of the day.
Yeah, we've got a great show for you today. When it comes to finding love, Gen Z is breaking up with dating apps. Fed up with swiping, they're now looking to meet people in, of all places, real life. And yet, as our colleague Paulina Prosnitz reports from New York this week, they're looking to do it in their own way. Did we mention cornhole leagues? Paulina has all the details. Then, if you're looking for another place to meet someone, here's an idea. How about a funeral? As Katya Kulowicz-Asante reports from Paris, in the Instagram age, funerals have now become a scene for social climbing as well as Instagramming. It's a story you want to hear. And finally, there are two great books out about two titans of music. The composer John Williams, best known for being the man who writes the scores for so many Steven Spielberg movies, and Leopold Stokowski, who scored some of Walt Disney's masterpieces. Our friend John Mauchery will join us with his reviews. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
I think we should always start with love. Our colleague Paulina Prosnitz, who's a junior editor here at Airmail, takes us inside postmodern courtship, if we can call it that. And let's just say it is a delightful alternative to the swipe. Welcome, Paulina.
Hi, guys.
Paulina, your story this week gave us such hope for the future. In it, you delve into how young people are meeting one another these days. And it turns out, Michael and I thought that they were just swiping on Hinge and Tinder and all of these dating apps we've never heard of. But we are partially wrong. What is going on?
So I think you're partially right. A lot of people in the Gen Z generation have grown up with dating apps, and a lot of them are still using them. But I think because of the fact that they've grown up with these apps, they're more quickly getting very fatigued with them. They've had their time on the apps, and they're just realizing that several aspects of them aren't working for them. And whether that's just fatigue with the structure and the swiping, or whether it's bad experiences with the dates themselves, there's just been a big movement in the past year or so to meet people in new ways.
Okay, so Paulina, we're going to, you know, take you back down memory lane here. When Michael and I were young, we used to meet people by, get ready, picking them up at bars or occasionally on the subway or the coffee shop. Is that what's happening again, or is this kind of a more orchestrated experience?
I think we call that IRL.
I think people hear about those kind of experiences, especially my age, and they want that again. It's just, it's more difficult now. And whether that's because dating apps have turned people off from meeting people organically in bars or for whatever reason, that's just not what's happening now. And what I was researching this week is basically people are looking for those IRL ways of meeting people, but they require a bit more structure than I think they may have about 20 years ago. And that's probably because dating apps have made things so structured. But yeah, basically what I was looking into this week is how Gen Z is going to sort of niche IRL activity-based clubs in order to meet people and as a way to sort of avoid the dating app black hole.
It's sort of like sending young children to school, right? Like just get them all in a room together and hope something good happens.
Exactly. I think that's what the organizers are promising. They're saying, we will structure it. You just need to come and we'll take the whole uncertain element out of things. Like you will come, you will meet people who are similarly looking to find someone to date, and you'll do a fun activity whilst meeting people.
So is this like finger painting or ping pong? Like what are the activities on offer here?
There's a range of activities, and some of them range from athletic events, like pickleball is really big, cornhole is popular, and then there's also, for the less athletically inclined, you can do backgammon or board game nights and stuff like that.
But Paulina, one of the things, you know, as you reveal in your reporting is, you know, kind of, well, not jokes aside, but, you know, you're saying this, your generation is trying to like, how do you do this? How do we find out? Like, as Ashley noted, you went to bars, you had a few drinks, you met people, you got some courage. But as you note, your generation is maybe the healthiest ever, and you're just not hanging out in bars or places where these things might have happened before?
Yeah. One of the women I talked to, one of the founders of a pickleball league that's been offering singles nights, made that point that Gen Z, more so than past generations, is less willing to drink and go to bars. And that's part of why these activity-based clubs are so popular, is because you can go on runs and meet someone. You can be playing pickleball. You can be playing, you know, beach volleyball or something and meet someone. And that, for a lot of Gen Z, is appealing because it doesn't involve late nights and drinking. And who knows, maybe that's a trend and eventually Gen Z will go back to the bars. But for now, yeah, there's been not only fatigue with the apps, but also with, you know, drinking and that lifestyle.
Ashley, you want to jump in here? I mean, just to go back to your point, how did you guys do that? You don't have to get blasted to go to a bar, but there was just something fun about hanging out in a bar with a bunch of people, right?
I mean, are you asking me, Michael? It's like how I spent my 20s.
Okay, Paulina, that's our gift to you.
Sorry. I mean, we also went to like concerts, by the way. Like there were bands playing. It was really fun. No, I mean, look, it was stressful. I always used to say the best place to pick up single men, like employed single men in New York City, is at the Chelsea Piers driving range. I had a golf phase in my 20s. You go there on a Saturday morning, there are so many good-looking guys, you know, passionate fans of the sport, and they're all single. Anyway, this is my pro tip for women of the world. I'm sure it has not changed since I used to play golf.
I know, Paulina, I just got to be a little cynical. Like cornhole? Hey, mom and dad, how'd you guys meet? We met playing cornhole. We're in a cornhole league.
Yeah. One of the more funny interviews I had was with a straight man coming from Chicago who had participated in one of the leagues, and he had been somewhat successful. He'd gone on a few dates that sounded like they went well. But he was explaining to me that the biggest problem with these kind of activity things, especially like when you're talking about cornhole or something that's, you know, maybe not the most masculine or athletic activity, that there was a big challenge in getting his straight male friends to join him at these events. And I think that's been a problem across these clubs. It's sometimes straight men may find that a bit embarrassing to be like, I need to join a cornhole league to find someone. And then if I meet someone, I need to tell people that I met at a cornhole league. And that's sort of up for debate, whether that's more or less embarrassing than meeting on Hinge or Tinder or something. But that was something funny that I learned in my conversations.
Thinking of like trying to do embarrassing things. When I was a single, I remember one point someone said, you know what you should really do to meet women? I said, what? It's like, they've got a place in Midtown where they teach line dancing and there's a lot of women there. I did not go. I'm just saying, it's pickleball for one generation, line dancing for another. Continue. Go ahead.
I mean, I was going to say, how much does all this cost? Being young is hard enough, especially in a city like New York City, where it costs you $9 just to get a drip coffee anymore. What does this cost? Who's paying for it? And do you find that it's sort of evenly divided between men and women, or who's more excited about this stuff?
I don't have the exact numbers, but like I was saying, it's much more difficult for the organizers of these events to get straight men to join. So I was talking to Tommy Flame, who was the founder of the Cornhole League, and he has been saying that he frequently runs promotions targeted towards specifically straight men, you know, discounted league prices and advertising campaigns, like full-blown campaigns to get straight men to join these leagues. So if you are a straight man, you have a good shot of getting a discounted ticket to join these leagues. But otherwise, the prices for pickleball leagues, backgammon league used to be free. And now I believe it's $5 to join for a night. And pickleball is less than $100 for a league. And for a singles night itself, I think the tickets go for, you know, between $30 and $40, which for the record is much less than you would pay to go on a dinner date with someone if you're a man.
Totally. It's like, that's like two drinks right now at like, you know, kind of a D-list bar in the East Village.
Exactly.
But I would also say, like, any single guys out there, I mean, there seems to be a pond full of single women at pickleball. So you should go there. The numbers are in your favor.
Exactly.
Gentlemen, that's my tip to you.
Well, Paulina, we kid, we jest, but we admire these enterprising young people who are out there looking for love, putting themselves on the line. We applaud you. It is not easy. And how ingenious to come up with this alternative to the digital life that so many of us find so draining.
Paulina, can we at least buy you a drink?
I would love that. Anytime.
Paulina, thank you so much. Great story.
Thank you, guys.
Michael, did this story give you a bit of nostalgia for your courtship of Brooke?
Well, sure, because it's happening in real life, you know, actually happened with us before phones and everything. So yeah, it's before smartphones.
I don't believe that. When did you guys get married?
It'll be 14 years next month.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, honey, the iPhone was invented in 2007. I'm sorry to tell you.
I know, but we started dating before that.
Were we texting or were we just, what do we call it? BBing? BBMing? BlackBerry messaging-ing?
BlackBerrying, yeah.
Those were the days when it was so annoying to text someone that you just said whatever and called them instead. It was heaven.
Yep, or you just said Y or N.
Late nights on the phone, long dates. Oh, those are the days. Romance. Michael, once again, I love being old. But you know what? I suppose there is a caveat to that because while I love being old, I certainly don't want to be dead. Although we do have a great story in the issue that makes being dead seem kind of chic, dare I say. Katia Kulwick-Asante, who is a writer based in France, is here to tell us all about how funerals of all possible events have become a CNBC spot for social climbers and an opportunity to wear your finest outfit. Welcome, Katia.
Thank you, Ashley.
Okay, so your story this week takes us inside a place that Michael and I, for one, probably never want to go, which is a funeral. But according to your reporting, actually, they're not all tragic, sad affairs anymore. What's going on?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, nobody is ever excited, you know, to talk about a funeral. And actually, it's never really planned. So, I mean, who wants to go there anyway? But it seems like, you know, lately, some little things, I mean, change. I saw, you know, some scenes in some movies. I saw a new campaign by Diesel showing a character in his coffin, you know, it's his own perspective on the photos. I thought that, you know, something like glamour, I mean, touches of glamour, just enter this moment, you know, this very private, this very sad moment that you don't have to talk about. You don't have to share it. You don't have something, it's something very intimate. So why would you expose it publicly?
You know, there's an old saying here in the US, you know, maybe it applies over in France and Europe, but like funerals are for the living. But it seems like as you report in the story this week, you know, more than ever, they're for the living because people want to see and be seen and kind of network and show up on Instagram. And you sort of detailed that most immediately or most recently with the scene at Giorgio Armani's sort of memorial service, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's a thought for Mr. Armani, who has a huge heritage. And one of his quote recently was, "Elegance is not about being noted, it's about being remembered." And I think what happened on this last day is the memorial in Milano and all this fashion designer coming in, sharing the thoughts for that moment. It showed that the funeral is also a moment that you can share, you know, with everyone. And it's true what you say. It's for the people who are alive, you know.
Well, it used to be you'd share your grief, but now it seems like you're sharing the content you created. And then speaking, you also linked him to the Vivienne Westwood Memorial Service, which you said was just filled with paparazzi getting pictures of celebrities, right?
Yeah, I think it was kind of the first funeral that was really shown picture-wise, like street photos or fashion week, you know. I mean, of course, it was a style. Of course, it was Victoria Beckham. Of course, it was a lot of fashion designers and a lot of style. I mean, and of course, it was an homage to Dame Vivienne. But I think it was a turning point that with some images that we haven't seen before. So that was 3 years ago, and it still went on.
Well, I have to say, even here in the US, I've seen back in the days when Ashley and I used to be on Instagram, I don't know about you, but like I'd see people posting, these are not celebrities. I've seen like people I follow, average people posting photographs of themselves at a funeral with friends. Like, hey, here we are giving a thumbs up. Are you guys thumbs up because you're reunited or because that's the final wishes of someone? It's just, it's a very, very bizarre and sort of performative thing that's happening now on social media at funerals, I found.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Michael. But I think the Instagram post, I mean, of course, asking for that is a craving for any pictures of any moment of life. And of course, it's not something that you would thought of sharing, I mean, even before. And it's funny because historically, I mean, the only funerals that were shown like in literature or in movies or in the series, it was only evil characters. You know, it was Corleone, it was a mean guy who was preparing his his legacy. I mean, he was plotting, you know, with some other members of the family or friends. It was a strategic moment. And it's funny because in my research, I saw that historically, I mean, in real life, some funerals were also strategic moments for people to gather and to prepare the future.
So speaking of gathering at funerals, you know, one of the details I love is you're there in France, in Paris. And, you know, then there's also people who, there used to be the state funeral, people would show for that. But, you know, sort of French politicians, especially Emmanuel Macron, who's had a hard week this week, but you detail he's sort of is a professional funeral goer, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I haven't noticed before, but doing my researches, I've seen, you know, I wanted to start from the Johnny Hallyday funeral in Paris because that was a national moment. It was a moment that was shared. I mean, a decision from the family to share it with all the people who were in the street around La Madeleine. Emmanuel Macron did a speech that day, as I say, with the sun in his eye, a scarf around his neck in front of the Madeleine. And from there, I started to watch like when exactly, I mean, politicians attended some funerals. And I've noticed that actually there were kind of a few for Emmanuel Macron who organized national funerals for several personalities. Actually, he did 32 in 7 years. And, you know, when you know that Sarkozy or Mitterrand organized only 4 when they were presidents.
Guess it's a way for him to like stand next to the celebrity, even though the celebrity can't stand up.
Actually, Katia, now that you mention this, I sort of want to make a guest list for my own. I realize how macabre that sounds. Even in death, like I still want to control things. Is that so wrong?
Well, yeah, that was kind of the thought because, you know, we have a famous TV anchor in France with Thierry Ardisson, who's been doing like some late shows in France for many years, and he passed away in July. And he asked everyone, I mean, he didn't ask for the dress code really, and everybody knew that he was called the Man in Black, so everybody wore black. And Brigitte Macron, for instance, wore leather pants, you know, which is quite unusual for a funeral. But he prepared like the whole playlist, you know, music so important. I mean, you know, which is going to play. So I was like, yeah, this is your last chance to say goodbye with, you know, people around you. So, I mean, you wanted, you know, to look like you, to feel like you.
Well, Katia, thank you so much. What a fun story. And we hope to talk to you again about an even sunnier topic.
Yeah, I'm sorry for this very dark story. But at the same time, you know, it's better to talk about it than not.
Fair enough. Thanks again.
Thanks to you.
I gotta say, funerals are not my favorite of all possible places.
That would be two of us.
Right? It's just a little macabre for me. Like, yeah, a celebration of life, whatever. I don't know. I can't help it. I'm sorry. I wish I were more evolved and could, you know, look at this in a more opportunistic way. But the idea of, you know, picking up a man or trying to get a new job or, you know, trying to like social climb my way to oblivion by attending a funeral, like I'd rather do almost anything else.
That'd be two of us. I'm with you. Okay, well, our next story is one I'm excited to talk about. There are two great new biographies out about two titans of music, the first being the British conductor Leopold Stokowski, and the other, the American composer John Williams, who is also Steven Spielberg's longtime collaborator, responsible for the music of such great movies as Jaws, Star Wars, and more. And we've got the always wonderful John Malcheri to talk about them.
Well, hi.
So, John, two new books. Tell us about them and the men they profile.
Yes, there's a new book about Stokowski. He's the kind of subject of a memoir by Nancy Shear, who was his musical assistant and someone who was obsessed with him from age 13 or so. And she stayed with him right through to his time of his death and in his middle 90s. And then there's the biography of John Williams, which is the first, and it's an enormous book. I mean, it is a book to keep your door from slamming shut by Tim Grieving. And those two books have come out around the same time. I thought it would be interesting to write about these two guys because they're strangely more similar than a person might think. And one of them is their personalities, which they didn't want anyone particularly to know anything about them. Stokowski remains a mystery in many ways, even though he was very public in his marriages and in his affairs, but also because he appeared in a few movies and famously shook hands with Mickey Mouse in Fantasia, which made him a movie star. I mean, he played himself. He didn't play other characters. And that caused a lot of feathers ruffling in the classical world. And at the same time, we've got John Williams, who is arguably, well, probably inarguably, the most famous living composer in the world, who's also quite reserved. And so we don't know very much about John. And even if you know John, you don't know very much about John.
Yeah, I want to ask you about John, because, I mean, obviously, I think many listeners probably know him best for, you know, Star Wars and working with Spielberg across the years. And yet, I think as you note in your review this week, you know, there's a whole kind of shadow narrative to Williams's life and even how he sort of like accepts or doesn't accept his work in Hollywood, right? And even how his contemporaries view him. So can you tell us a little bit about Williams and his background and how he came to do what he does and how he's perceived now?
Well, that's one of those questions that could take us to next year around this time. But let me just say this, the part of what John represents, and he's now, what, 93, 94, he's in that era. He is the last living link right through to the founding composers of sound film, right? Those refugees, the emigres. And he knew and worked with a number of them as a young man. That means that his link in how you write music and what music should sound like and how what continuity is and the whole idea of absorbing everything happening in the world and recreating it in your own language. And so he is that person. That part about him, I think, is unquestioned as far as what people, what critics think of his music, if that matters at all, but also what he thinks of his music is, I think, the part that makes this book so especially interesting. And I think that the shadow story in this book, yes, you'll learn a lot about a lot of movies that you maybe forgot or didn't know he worked on. You'll learn a lot. You won't learn much about John. I mean, you'll know about his two marriages, and you'll learn about how many children he has. But you really won't know what's going on inside him. And I don't think Tim Grieving wanted to go there, and certainly because John agreed to participate in this book. Because at first, he really objected. He said, why would anybody care about anything about me except, you know, my music? But what he learned, what Tim learned, which in a way is obvious from the music John writes, is that there's two John Williamses, right? There's the one who writes the music for all these films, the music that the world adores, loves, you know, fascinating, all kinds of different kinds of music, by the way. They're not all the same. They're really quite different. And then there's his concertos, the music he writes for symphony orchestra. And they sound like another person. They don't sound like John at all. They sound, you know, modern, and I put in quotation marks. And this split between my popular music and what I consider serious music, John is one of the few and maybe the last living composer who sees music that way. Because, you know, in a way you could argue Leonard Bernstein went through that too. I mean, he wrote musicals, and when he wrote West Side Story in 1957, he then became music director of the New York Philharmonic. And then he stopped writing for Broadway. And he's also, during this time, writing symphonies. And his classical music gets more and more complex and dense, as if he is unwilling to give us another tune. Because this whole idea that in order to write classical music that's serious in the 20th century, it has to be non-tonal and kind of, you know, very heavily dissonant, right? And so John's concertos don't sound like John very much. I mean, you have to really think about that. So the same thing was true of Ennio Morricone, such a great composer. For film, he wrote music that sounded like Mahler, sounded a little bit like the same kind of world that John Williams embraces, only a much more European, Italian, German music. So his music is so full of wonderful melodies and inventive stuff. But his classical music, his concert music, is atonal. So we have this world of, why do we write in two different languages? Now, I asked Morricone that question, and he said to me in Italian, to respect the genre. In other words, from Morricone's point of view, movie music sounds like that, and classical music does not sound anything like that. But the argument here has been perpetuated and perpetrated, two big P words, by a kind of a strange attitude toward what is classical music of our time. So I was interested that Tim Grieving's book talks about this. And Tim keeps pointing out that his score, that John's scores, whether it's Star Wars, especially the second score, but then also AI, which I agree with him is probably the greatest score he ever wrote. These are full scores. I mean, these are not little tunes that just pop up in out of silence. And even Hans Zimmer said, you know, the brilliance of Jaws is not the but everything that happens between the duh, 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 and the next time duh, 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 comes in. He said that's as great a contemporary avant-garde music as anybody's ever written. So within the world of music, this strange world of music, there seem to be two different attitudes toward music that people like, that's contemporary, and therefore is not serious, and music that people find really challenging and maybe most people don't like, and that's serious music. And that's crazy. Now, the bottom line is this. John apparently fully believes that his film music is of a much lower quality than his symphonic music. It's just, I'm going to work and I have to write this stuff. And that, of course, is shocking to see and to read. And Tim is in a way telling us what many of us believe, but also maybe telling John himself. John, you know, you're acting like you've never read your own CV, right? Come on, these are gigantic scores, hours of music, developmental, new melodies, new characters. And in the case of Star Wars, of course, that goes over people's lifetimes. And so I found that to be really interesting. And I do hope that John, we may never persuade John that his film music is as good or as valuable as his concertos. But I can tell you that as the years go on, and just when the audience just really knows what it loves and wants to hear it, that's an important thing to know. It's so precious, this ability he has.
It's funny, like, what's one definition of great art? It touches you, it connects with you, it makes you feel, right? And, you know, one might say from the outside that the other side of the music world, which is like, no, it must be stiff and formal and have this thing. But like, it's pretty hard to write something that billions of people love and respond to. And that's a good thing. But it's you know, you exist sometimes in a world where the art form says, no, it has these structures and strictures. And, you know, it's the person working on the other side of that line sometimes can feel like, maybe my contemporaries aren't going to respect me as much.
That's why we also talk that one of the characters in Tim's book about John Williams is Andre Previn. Now, I knew Andre, and Andre was a terrible snob. And he kept on to John about stop writing this crappy film music. You've got to write some serious music. And I think that the influence of someone like Andre, you know, Mia Farrow said, they saw each other as, you know, as brothers. Johnny Williams kind of saw Andre as his older brother. And Andre, after winning his Academy Awards and, you know, arranging music for My Fair Lady and Gigi and all that work at MGM, he writes a book called No Minor Chords, in which he makes fun of everybody involved with music in Hollywood. He goes to London, he becomes Andre Previn, the serious conductor, and then writes music. But I would argue, okay, so who's playing any of Andre's music today? So we're so blessed that John has written so many hundreds of hours of great symphonic. It's kind of interesting.
Beyond interesting, John. I mean, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show and to look at these two men. And as you remind us, like, their links with history and across generations into their art forms, and you know, to hear you speak so passionately about them. So we're so fortunate to have you, and want to thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's so good to talk to you.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene: AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our weekly culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Well, on that note, it is the weekend, and we wish you a wonderful one. But before we go, Michael, please, how should we spend our time this weekend?
It's a book written by a friend of ours here at AIRMEL, Elliot Ackerman. It's called Sheepdogs. It's a great novel. It's about two kind of down on their luck ex-military pals named Cheese and Squirrel, of all things, who take a gig to repossess a private jet with a mysterious cargo that's being held hostage in Uganda. Cheese is a former flying ace from the Afghan Air Force who's reduced now to kind of working nights at a Texas gas station when we meet him. And Squirrel, on the other hand, was discharged for conduct unbecoming a member of the CIA. He goes by the name Squirrel, as you'll learn, because he can get anything you need. Needless to say, things get complicated and I think also very funny. Ackerman, as you probably know, is a Marine veteran who served in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he brings all the kind of military insight and expertise in this, and then layers a great kind of comic caper on top of it. So it's a great kind of two-hander, and it's a terrific, fun read. As I say, if you're kind of waiting for slow horses to start up, why not fill it with Sheepdogs by Elliot Ackerman? It's in bookstores now. And you, my dear?
Sign me up. Thanks to you, I've been watching Platonic, Michael.
And?
I love it. I think it's great. Actually, you know, I'm such a Rose Byrne super fan, and the fact that she's married to Bobby Cannavale just puts me in a great mood because I love the two of them. In fact, I saw them in this great play at BAM in New York a couple years ago. It was quite epic. I forgot the name of it, but they played a married couple in that. Anyway, Rose Byrne can do little wrong in my book. Bridesmaids, also one of my favorite movies of all time, which will come as no surprise. So I think it's a really fun show, and she has such great chemistry. I mean, such ridiculous chemistry with Seth Rogen, and the two of them starring as these kind of improbable best friends, I think makes for a really fun conceit for a comedy series. So I just love it.
She is so winning and she's so funny. She's just got great delivery, great laugh. I mean, she just sparkles in this thing. So she kind of steals it for me.
Now, I have to ask you, have you read Elizabeth Gilbert's new memoir?
Oh, no, I haven't. I've just read the profiles and some of the reviews about it. Have you?
No, I'm dying to read it, actually. And mainly because the reviews have been, I think, so crushing. I mean, Liz Egan, who I don't know, but apparently is one of the nicest people alive, was pretty savage in the New York Times, I thought. So anyway, Elizabeth Gilbert being the very well-known memoirist who became a bit of a sensation with her, I believe it was her first book. It was Eat, Pray, Love, which became the movie starring Julia Roberts. Anyway, she's written several memoirs and novels since. Her new one is called All the Way to the River, Love, Loss, and Liberation. And it's about her latest love affair, which was with her best friend who was diagnosed with pancreatic and liver cancer right around the time that they got together. It was, you know, excerpted in New York Magazine, and there's been a lot of conversation around it, but I'm dying to know what you think. I guess we should read it and regroup next week.
Yeah, I'll read it. I mean, Liz, you know, she was originally a writer for us when I was at GQ and did some great profiles there, some great stories, one of which was Coyote Ugly, about working on this bar on the Lower East Side, made into a movie as well. Super talented writer, good friend when we were there. I'll read the book and let's reconvene.
Yes, indeed. It is the talk of literary New York at this moment. Well, we thank you all so much for joining us. We wish you a marvelous weekend. And Michael, will you please read us out?
Morning Meeting is produced by AirPlay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. And our deputies are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davison. Our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AirMail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and join all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AirMail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.